Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. And you're listening to New Books in Military History. Today I'm speaking with Beth Bailey, Foundation Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Kansas. We're discussing her great new book, An Army of Fire, How the U.S. Army Confronted Its Racial Crisis in the Vietnam Era, from UNC Press. An Army of Fire details the racial strife between black and white soldiers fighting a grueling war in Vietnam. It examines the causes and major events that led to tensions and infighting, and how the U.S. Army attempted to resolve what they termed the problem of race. Beth, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First off, I just want to mention that this was an extremely readable book, and that's not always the case for academic books, but this book was really just easy to read, and I think just a great introduction to thinking about some of the other ways of thinking about the Vietnam War, and just the unbelievable layers to it. And I thought that you took sort of the two elements of the Vietnam era and combine them in this way that was really fascinating. But before jumping to the book, I was wondering if you could just tell me a little about yourself and your background.
Sure. But first, let me say thank you. I really appreciate that. I always try to write something that people want to read and try to find people to bring the history to life. So it means a lot that you said that. So, as you said, I'm a Foundation Distinguished Professor at the University of Kansas, and I run the Center for Military War and Society Studies here. I have had somewhat unusual career in that I began as a cultural historian who studied gender and sexuality, and my first book was on the history of dating. I moved to military history as a kind of, I don't know, midlife crisis, mid-career. I'm getting bored with this. I want to do something different. And began knowing so little about the military that I was making flashcards so that I could recognize rank insignia, which, you know, was not an auspicious beginning, but it was an essential one. And so I'm a military historian in the sense that I write about the military as an institution, as opposed to an operational history or war and society history. And I've written a fair number of books or edited books about the U.S. military, the recent U.S. military, including America's Army, Making the All-Volunteer Force, and then co-edited books on managing sex in the U.S. military and understanding the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Beyond Pearl Harbor, which starts with the almost simultaneous Japanese attacks all over the Pacific on December 7th and 8th and goes on from there. As I said, I really, really enjoy writing. I enjoy archival research. And this book came out of almost, I hate to say it, 10 years of delving into archives and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with this story. Not that I didn't do other things in the meantime, but this book has been a very long labor of love.
I love that you talked about how you started your career in a completely different field and then moved into another one. I think that that's always great and fascinating when scholars start in one area and then move to another, and it just allows for different perspectives to come through. You sort of ended the question with the question that I want to ask now, which is just how did the idea for this book come about?
Well, when you do something like jump fields so dramatically the way I did, especially before there were as many people who were bringing questions about things like gender and sexuality or social change to the study of the military, you're always being asked if there's any kind of logic to what you're doing, whether there's anything that holds it together. And I have written more than one grant application or, you know, application for promotion where I had to make sense of that move. And I've always been really interested in how social change happens. And I like to think about how people try to solve problems. And by that, I mean individuals or institutions or organizations, nations, organizations of various sorts. And so this book took on a problem that I had glimpsed, more than glimpsed, that I had encountered as I was writing about the U.S. Army's transition to the all-volunteer force in the late 60s and early 70s when all of the discussions were going on, which was the issue of race. And the racial crisis, the racial violence that was breaking out in the ranks. And I just wanted to understand how the Army tried to address that problem, because I wanted to think about how it solved problems. And I think the moment I realized that I was going to write the book the way I wrote it was a conversation I had with a very close friend of mine who died a few years ago. He showed up in a course I was teaching on war and American culture at the University of New Mexico. He was late 50s at that point. He had been a LRP, a long-range reconnaissance patrol in the Army during the Vietnam War. He had been a recruiter. And we got to be really good friends after I left the university and he no longer was a student of mine. And I would go to him to ask questions, and I kept sending him emails and, you know, telling him something, and he kept sending me back. It's like, yeah, that's what it says. That's not what it means. No, you're not getting it. You're not getting it. And finally he said, you're trying to make sense of the Army like it's a university. It's not. You're trying to make sense of this in the context that you have, the world you live in. This is a different world. And something clicked, and I started thinking, I want to understand how the Army as an institution defined this problem and how it tried to solve it based on its own sense of itself as an institution, its leaders' own sense of the institution they worked in. And that's what made this book, that it started out with, you know, just sort of a vague interest in this racial crisis and Army attempts to figure out what to do. It made it gel. And from then on, I knew what I was doing.
So, something that you mention in the introduction of the book is that it was a common view at the time in the 1960s and even earlier that the U.S. Army was a sort of a model of racial progress. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little about the sort of history of the U.S. Army from desegregation until the events in the book and why the U.S. Army was seen this way.
The U.S. Army was not 100% on board with the notion of racial integration, to say the least. And Truman's order never really mandated racial integration, in fact. It was not until after the Korean War that the Army was considered to be fully racially integrated. But by the early 1960s, the Army's narrative and a set of understandings that was largely endorsed by Black leaders and by Black members of the Army was that the Army offered better opportunities to African Americans than civilian society did. That the Army was a place that believed in color blindness. The phrase, I see only one color and that's OD, olive drab, was a little bit too omnipresent. It suggested a little bit of defensiveness there. But there was truth to that. It says more about civilian society's failures probably than it said about the Army's successes. But many young men believed and found some truth to the fact that they found greater opportunity in the U.S. military than they found in civilian society. And generally, you could find all sorts of discussion about how the Army was leading the way or the U.S. military was leading the way in racial integration. It was a model for the way that the American society in general should try to approach the questions, should try to solve the problems that it confronted as it ended Jim Crow, legal Jim Crow, and started to think about how a more equitable society would look. One of my favorites is an NBC special called Same Mud, Same Blood that traced a unit in Vietnam, a combat unit in Vietnam, and talked about how its members had transcended the divides of race and know, again, this was something that was very much cast in a certain way to make a case. That journalist really relied on about six people and carefully chose out of a month of interviewing the quotes that he was going to use, the footage that he was going to use. He wanted to make the case for transcendence. But it was the way in which people talked about the military at that time, that it was a greater place for opportunity for Black people than civilian society. And the fact that the army didn't blow up as the violence in the American streets in the mid-60s on showed was taken as evidence that they were succeeding.
What impact did the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. have on soldiers in Vietnam, particularly Black officers, recruits, and draftees? Obviously, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. had a massive impact back in the United States, but what was the particular impact in Vietnam itself?
Well, I'm writing not just about Vietnam, but about the U.S. military throughout the world at this point. So within the United States, but particularly in West Germany, in Japan and Korea and elsewhere. And again, the army leaders were really proud that things had not blown up in the U.S. Army around the assassination of Martin Luther King. There were some fights that broke out. There were some words exchanged. There were some egregious behavior on the part of some white soldiers who did things like, post hang Confederate flags or offer insults to Black soldiers. But it had a longer impact. So the fact that some white soldiers celebrated the assassination of Martin Luther King, the fact that at times officers refused to let Black soldiers attend memorials that were set up, had a long force, it created a shadow, it created distrust that would come to fruition later. So the immediate impact might have not been so much, but the impact, the longer-term impact was great. And the fact that the U.S. Army was bringing people in steadily from civilian society throughout this time during the war in Vietnam meant that a lot of young men who had experienced the upheaval and the anger and the frustration and the sense of hopelessness that this assassination brought then came into the Army bringing with them those sentiments and those experiences meant that what happened to the Army in 1968 might not matter so much as what happened in civilian society in 1968 as those young men that came into the U.S. military.
One of the events that you discuss in the book of a moment of particular tension was the uprising at Long Binh Jail. So I was wondering if you could describe what happened here, sort of as an example for maybe how the worse that things got.
So there was an uprising at Long Binh Jail, which was at the massive Long Binh post outside of Saigon, that took place simultaneously with the riots in the streets, the attacks on protesters at the Democratic National Convention in August of 1968. So you can see that the turn to violence was not something that was limited to race or limited to the war in Vietnam, the soldiers who are fighting the war in Vietnam on the U.S. side. A group of prisoners in a prearranged action rose up, attacked guards, burned buildings to the ground, beat guards and other prisoners. It was Black personnel who were incarcerated there, along with a few Hispanic personnel, and seized control of a large part of the prison of the stockade and held control for weeks. After they seized control, they tried to set up what they saw as an African space, and they improvised using army blankets to form what they called the shikis, and they created sort of pseudo-African drums, and they made very clear that their whole goal here was to create a space that was Black, that was, in their view, African. And what was striking to me was not only the level of violence, and I do want to reiterate that a lot of the people who were involved in this uprising were not there because they had done something like, refused to say yes, sir, or get a haircut. This was a place that by 1968 had a lot of prisoners of all races and ethnicities who had done things that are truly egregious. But the Army wasn't willing to confront that it was about race, that it was about African-American soldiers' sense that they were being disproportionately punished and incarcerated and treated differently. And the after-action report that the military police put out gave all sorts of suggestions about how to avoid uprisings like this in the future, and it never once mentioned race. And so I saw this story that I tell in some detail in the book as not only a precursor of what is to come, the violence that is to come, but also a sign of how reluctant Army leaders were to confront the underlying crisis of race that was yielding the violence, the anger, and the explosions that it was going to have to come.
One of the central figures of the book is Major Lavelle Merritt. And I was wondering if you could talk about who he was and what he tried to do to address the racism that Black soldiers were facing.
So Lavelle Merritt is also... the story of Lavelle Merritt is parallel to the story of Long Bend Jail. They happened the same summer. And in some other ways, this book does owe itself to Lavelle Merritt, because when I first started doing a little bit of exploration, trying to figure out whether there was a book here, the National Archives, under the criteria of U.S. Army race, had a single file, and that single file contained one piece of paper, which was a photocopy of an article about Lavelle Merritt. Lavelle Merritt was a major in the U.S. Army who had served well and was assigned to a training unit in Vietnam, and he was the only Black officer there. He was growing increasingly frustrated about the ways in which both institutional and personal racism had impacted his own career, but more broadly about the ways in which racism shaped the lives of Black people in the United States. And he took it upon himself to try to educate his subordinates and peers about this topic. He, according to his fellow officers, tended to corner people in the mess hall or in other sites and try to make them understand what he felt so powerful. He got frustrated enough one night in the bar, having had a few drinks, as had almost everybody else in there, that he threw a chair across the room. The accounts of what happened really vary. Sometimes it sounds as if he sort of gave it an underhanded toss. Other times it sounds as if he really hurled it with all force. And he ended up being brought up on charges of not acting as an officer and a gentleman, and other such charges. And the fundamental charge was that he was obsessed with the problem of race. Now, on some level, he probably was. But on another level, he was trying to say something that the Army needed to hear. And what he did was to go into a press briefing in Saigon and hand out an 8-page manifesto in which he said the U.S. military is the greatest citadel of racism on the face of the earth. And he went on in detail to explain how he saw this world. And just like with the Long Bend Jail, the Army didn't want to confront race. The Army didn't want to hear the story that he was trying to tell. And so both the story of Long Bend Jail and the story of Lavelle Merritt, to my mind, signaled how Black soldiers and officers, and Merritt was unusual in the sense because it was usually not Black officers who were carrying this message, were trying to make Army leaders listen to what they had experienced and understand the crisis that lay at the heart of race relations in the U.S. military, and how reluctant Army leaders were to hear that. So when a change comes, it is a profound change.
Another figure that you talk about is Stanley Reeser, and he's sort of on the opposite side of the table. He's a white guy who's in a very high position of power in the U.S. Army. And I was wondering if you could talk about his views and how he interpreted the racial problem, and ultimately, like, the defining and putting this in quotations, the problem of race.
So Stanley Reeser was the Secretary of the Army. And in 1969, he went before the Association of the U.S. Army and gave a speech in which he essentially said that the racial crisis that the Army was experiencing was second only to the U.S. war in Vietnam in terms of what the Army should be worrying about. Now, he was building on work that had already been done under William Westmoreland, who was chief of staff of the Army, who had appointed a commission to try and look into what was going on in terms of race relations in the Army. And in his speech, he heavily quoted a lieutenant colonel named James White, African-American lieutenant colonel, who had been an integral part of this committee. But what Stanley Reeser said is that, and I'm using the language of the time that was the respectful language that was preferred by most older Black leaders, he said, you know, you can put a, quote, Negro in uniform, but that doesn't just turn him into a soldier. He becomes a Negro soldier. So what he's saying is that all of this talk about colorblindness, all this talk about I see only one color and that's OD, is in the language of the time a cop-out, that we have to recognize race, that the U.S. Army, in its assumptions of colorblindness, defaults white, that when we see only one color and that's OD, that OD is white. And so if we say, everybody's hair should be cut the same way, and that way is defined as white wall, which is something that is only possible for white people, we are failing to treat people equally. We have to see difference in order to provide equality. Equality cannot be colorblind. And he and William Westmoreland set out a major and ambitious program to try to confront this crisis, this racial crisis that was beginning to explode in the Army, the violence that was happening, the resistance that was happening, the anger that was happening, the fights between Black and white service members, because they believed, as did many other senior leaders, that this racial crisis, this racial conflict, was threatening the ability of the U.S. Army to fulfill its mission of national defense. They might have believed morally it was a good thing to do, but the reason that they took this action is because they believed that the mission of the U.S. Army was in threat.
What was the reception of Stanley Reeser's views? I know he gave a speech on this matter, and he, you know, it was something that, like as you said, that he was extremely concerned about. So, what was the reception like?
Well, that's the thing about the military is that people can issue orders and they can enforce orders. And so the reception varied enormously, especially among the officers. Some people were heavily committed, Black and white, to notions of racial equality and racial justice. Some white officers were dyed-in-the-wool segregationists that were extraordinarily racist. I'd say, having read a lot of private papers, that they fell on the side of the angels more often than on the side of the devils. But nonetheless, there was a difference. But when the Secretary of the Army and the Chief of Staff of the Army tell you what to do, you follow those orders. Implementation was more or less enthusiastic, but what the Army did was, and this surprises me every time I see it, was to employ a great deal of creativity to try and figure out, okay, what do we do to solve this problem? This problem threatens our existence. How do we solve it? And because of the way the Army functions, there was a lot of incentive to come up with solutions, because if you come up with a solution that functions, you're going to get attention. Your program or you yourself are going to benefit in terms of the structure of the Army. So quite a few people really invested heavily in trying to come up with solutions to what they saw as a function.
Something that you describe in the book is the Racial Harmony Council that took place at Fort Carson. And I was wondering if you could talk about this event and what was discussed and the outcomes of it.
A lot of the point I'm trying to make in the book is that we have to understand the institutional culture of an organization, the institutional logic of an organization, to see how it's going to define a problem and then try to solve it. And when I say institutional logic, I mean the culture and history and traditions, the policy and practices, the organization. And so what I tried to do was to say, okay, how did the military try to solve the problems? And the first place that the Army is going to look, Army leaders are going to look, is leadership. And so they said, it's the responsibility of the commander. Whatever happens is the responsibility of the person in command. And Fort Carson, the Race Relations Council is, you know, in many ways my favorite example of what happened. But Army leaders started to say, okay, we have a real advantage over civilian society because what we can do is issue orders and enforce them. But rank hierarchy also creates a problem. People who are, you know, junior officers and NCOs closer to the men and women they command don't really want to send up the ladder that I'm failing to address a problem. I'm doing a bad job here. And a lot of times when policies are created, the implementation as it goes down the hierarchy becomes a little bit loose and has a lot of flexibility depending on how people closest to those enlisted troops interpret it. So at Fort Carson and in some other places, the senior leaders created what they called either enlisted men's councils or race relations councils, which were made up of low-ranking enlisted men. In this case, it was mostly Black men. There were a couple of others. And they put these enlisted men in frequent, if not daily, contact with the senior leader on post. So at Fort Carson, this group of privates was meeting daily with, if I remember correctly, a 3-star general, and explaining to him what they saw as the problems. And the whole notion was is they were supposed to speak directly. They were supposed to pay no attention to the protocol of rank. And you end up with, a private calling a general an effing pig. You end up with a lot of very direct language being used. But you do end up with often a sense of, well, we are getting heard, and generals who are willing to take action to try and forestall what they see as crisis. At Fort Carson, it was interesting because there was a young man at the time named Darnell Summers, who had in fact been incarcerated and charged with killing a police officer, which seems to have been a false charge, had been released and was there. And he became very close to General DeWitt Smith and had a profound impact on General Smith's understanding of the racial crisis. So on one of the things, what happened is that it sometimes created trust. It sometimes forestalled violence or explosions. On the other hand, all the NCOs and junior officers who were trying to manage the men, white, Black, other, day-to-day to enforce order and discipline, often found their authority undercut because we have privates who, you know, just simply walk around all those junior officers and NCOs and go straight to the general and complain about them. So it was highly creative. It was based on leadership. It was based on the notion that there are natural leaders out there and we can use them. We can use their leadership qualities. But it undercut the authority of junior officers and NCOs. And it also created a constant problem because these young men rotated out. They weren't lifers. And so they just had to keep identifying people, building trust, identifying. But that was one of the examples of how they turned to leadership because it was what was the most obvious solution to Army leaders. But then they used notions of leadership that counteracted and contradicted Army logic of rank hierarchy and, to some extent, order and discipline.
Another thing that you discuss in the book, and I think this is another interesting example of how the Army attempted to address problems, was the employment of Willie Lee Morrow, a Black barber from San Diego. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about his story, because it really is so fascinating. And reading this section, I was just like really blown away by it. So can you talk about him?
Willie Lee Morrow is just amazing entrepreneur. He had grown up in Alabama, I believe, and ended up out in Southern California as a barber, but a barber who was building an empire. He wrote a book that was very well received about cutting Black hair. He eventually invented the Afro pick, and he came up with a whole series of chemical treatments that would make him a good deal of money in the future. But what was happening in the military as we got away from the question is leadership is, you know, what are young men complaining about? And young Black men who were coming into the Army out of a world in which Black pride and Black identity was ever more at the center of understandings of visibility and one's sense of self in American society, in a society that had discriminated against them and marginalized them for so long. They discovered that what a lot of young men in the military, white and black, cared about profoundly was hair, their haircuts. And this was particularly true of black men who wanted to be able to wear an afro, who said that the haircut that the army insisted upon was the haircut of slaves. It was the haircut of those people who had been stripped of their rights and enslaved by the white man. And so the army decided to experiment with allowing black men to wear what the army called afros. It was a highly modified afro, but, you know, it could be sort of picked out, teased out, or pushed down to sit in under caps. And they sent Willie Lee Morrow all over the world to train local barbers throughout the world in how to cut black hair. And they also stopped treating the afro as a, quote, specialty haircut and treated it as just another haircut. And before, what they had done essentially is say, if you're black, you have to pay more for haircuts because you don't fit the normal, quote, haircut. And Willie Lee Morrow had interviews with the Pacific and the Stars and Stripes and said, I understand what afros mean to black soldiers. It's a sign of their identity. It's a sign of black pride. And the army went on board. Army logic, though, if you allow one group to do something because it is an important symbol to them, you have to allow all groups to do something that's an important symbol to them. And so, as black soldiers said, we want to be able to wear afros as a sign of black pride and black power. We want to wear what they called slave bands or slave bracelets to show our history. Some Southern white soldiers started saying, well, we want to recognize our culture, too. We want to fly the Confederate flag. And in fact, Army leaders would say proudly, yes, we make no distinction. You know, we allow people to wear the quote, slave band and to fly the Confederate flag as if they were doing something that was progressive. And obviously, flying the Confederate flag was not improving race relations, let's say, in the U.S. military. So again, they try something that violates the notions of uniformity by allowing people to claim an identity other than soldier, but then they have to contend with the problems. If everything's uniform and you allow some people's symbols, you have to allow everybody's symbols. We're running into problems with our institutional logic. And so basically they just said you can't fly any flag but the Union flag and the U.S. flag.
I would love if you could talk a little, just generally about the institutional logic of the Army. You've brought it up a couple of times, but I think, I would love to hear just about, the notion of institutional logic and then how it applies to the U.S. Army in this case.
Well, that's what I ended up building this book around, is thinking about social change and how it happens. And I told you the story about my friend David Pankey, and you know, you're trying to make sense of the Army like it's a university. But I was also writing this book after the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent protest. And so I was thinking an awful lot about how social change comes. And, you know, even the most devoted activists don't believe that activism is the end point. In order for social change to happen, it has to be incorporated into the culture of the nation. It has to be incorporated into its laws and into its institutions. And so the U.S. military, especially at this moment, was a massive institution. I think 1.9 million young men and some women were members of the U.S. military during the Vietnam era. So I wanted to think about, what does it mean to incorporate demands for change, whether those demands are itemized and practical, or whether they are just in a language of rage and violence. How do you incorporate those demands for change into an institution? And my argument is that for anybody involved, understanding the institutional logic of the institution is central, because if you understand what's going to make people in the institution care about it, and you're somebody seeking change, it gives you a tool to use. And it also helps you understand when you have to just reject that institutional logic, because there's nothing that's going to make them care and step outside and exert a different kind of pressure. And if you're somebody in an institution who's looking at demands for change, sympathetically or not sympathetically, Understanding the institutional logic helps you think about how to address those demands in the best possible fashion. If you are either wanting to or forced to address demands, understanding how your institution functions helps you think about what's going to be the most efficient and practical and useful way to address those demands. So the Army, in some sense, it's what I write about. It's a major, powerful institution that we should care about. But it's also a case study for people to think about institutional change in general and how one can bring it about. And I think the fundamental lesson I came away with here is that individuals make a huge difference. Despite racism that is structural, despite racism that is institutional, despite racism or other forms of discrimination or problems that are interwoven into the structure of the institutions involved, it made an enormous difference when individuals acted. Individuals who were protesting, individuals who were in positions of authority, individuals who were trying to manage things on a local level, it made a huge difference. And that's a positive lesson that I can come away from the book with.
Yeah, I suppose, in conclusion, how do you think about on two levels? One, was the U.S. Army, obviously we know that the U.S. Army was not successful in Vietnam, ultimately, but was the U.S. Army successful in addressing the racial crisis and, making it so that the problems that the U.S. Army was fundamentally facing were, related to battle and operational problems. And then, also, how do you view, outside of just the comparing it to the U.S. Army's ability to stabilize, how do you think about what they ultimately did and what it means or meant for the future of the U.S. Army going forward?
So the goal of Army leaders was to stabilize the U.S. Army. The goal of Army leaders was to manage the threat to Army efficacy from the racial crisis and the racial violence that it was experiencing. And it succeeded. It succeeded in its goal. So, yes, it succeeded. Did it succeed in ending racism and racial discrimination and institutional problems within the Army in regard to race? Well, obviously not completely. We still certainly face problems within. I might say that issues of gender may be more pressing today than issues of race, just given the rate of sexual harassment and assault that we continue to see. But those are two separate things. But because the Army was acting in its own interest in trying to stabilize the U.S. Army as an institution, it made fundamental changes that improved the lives of people of color in the Army. It addressed questions of communication and leadership and recognized the significance of listening to the voices of those people who are advocating for change. It instituted training and education programs. It looked again at the process of military justice and did a whole lot of analysis trying to understand why Black servicemen were being given Article 15's nonjudicial punishment and also incarcerated at higher rates than white servicemen were. It began a program of affirmative action in a long-term effort to try to make sure that Black officers were at least proportional to their population in the United States, something that couldn't be solved or addressed immediately because it's a long-term process as raising up a general officer. And it really, to its own ends, thought hard about race. It bureaucratized race. It made race a category that had to be addressed. It could not be ignored. And that changed the experience of people of color in the U.S. Army to the better.
You do talk about how this was seen as an issue among the male soldiers, that even if the Women's Army Corps made up a small portion of the Army, it was still around 13,000 people. So, I was wondering if you could just briefly touch on the aspect of gender at play here.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing to write a book in which there are essentially no women. And I was highly conscious of that and trying to figure out whether I should be trying to weave in the story of women more. But because I was looking at institutional logic, what I saw was that the army leaders were not really concerned about women threatening the stability of the U.S. military. Enlisted women were a very small, small percentage of the military. They were not going to be sent into combat. They tended, with a few exceptions, not to, you know, advocate for change in the same fashion. They certainly were much less likely to have violent uprisings than the men were. And so all of the solutions that were proposed were really very much male-focused because the Army was worried about racial violence and conflict, and women weren't causing problems. It also is very Black-white focused because the conflict was coming between Black and white soldiers. There were other members, other races and ethnicities represented in the U.S. military, and they were often mentioned in some kind of overview, but then they disappeared because members of those groups were not perceived by military leaders, by Army leaders, as causing problems. It was African-American troops, by and large, who were fed up with the racism they encountered, who were concerned with advocating for racial justice, and the conflict that they had were with white soldiers, many of whom were not pleased with the challenge to the status quo, but sometimes were just, you know, were sometimes attacked simply because they were white, because they represented whiteness. And so it became a male problem and it became a white and Black problem. Other women were on the periphery. Members of other race and ethnicities were acknowledged and then quickly dismissed because they weren't forcing the Army to confront an issue at that moment.
Yeah, no, thank you for that answer. It's interesting. I think it's really interesting the way that you put it, and also sometimes the tension between what you want to put in, what you want to find, you know, the evidence that you want to find, and then what evidence actually is there, and, you know, going by what's there, the fact that the Army wasn't focused on women, then deciding to focus on what the evidence is showing you.
To point out that silence and to explain that silence, not simply to accept the Army's terms. I mean, what I'm trying to do is to say, look, this is how they defined it. We have to analyze why they defined it that way and what it meant to define it that way, not just to accept the definitions that they had, but to explore the implications of those definitions. And because they were worried about the stability of the military, not because they were acting because they were worried about the stability of the Army, not because they were committing themselves to a moral endeavor of social equality, even if some people certainly believed that that was a goal that should be embraced.
Yeah, no, and the book really does show that this, you know, you do a great job of tracing, you know, where is it that institutional logic is leading the day, and where is it that, you know, moral concern occasionally rears its head, and just the tension between those two. I think it is definitely one of those books where, even though it's about the past, just is extremely relevant and useful to think of, to use the framework that you've outlined to think about contemporary issues. Well, Beth, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was great speaking with you. The book is An Army of Fire: How the U.S. Army Confronted Its Racial Crisis in the Vietnam Era, from UNC Press.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Of course, it was wonderful.